And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with Old Starling. And this is a YouTuber from Scotland, like me. It was quite lonely for quite a long time. There weren't many other, well, I mean, now you are the only, since I got banned. But point is, there aren't many voices like ours from Scotland. So welcome to Millennial. This is a debut first timer. So please introduce yourself to the audience.
Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me on. I go by Old Starling. I started a YouTube channel a year ago. It was more of an experiment where I wanted to learn how to edit. My plan was to learn how to edit with the goal. Well, it was just one of the skills I wanted to learn because my missus and I are planning to go abroad, trying to do a bit of traveling. So I thought I'd just make a based YouTube channel where, you know, I wanted to learn how to edit and maybe, you know, what could I actually, you know, what could I edit? And I realized I need to make my own stuff. And deep down, I need to be an authentic chud. You know, that's really the end of it. And here we are, a year later. You've stumbled across the channel. You seem to like it. And here we are.
Yeah, it's a very different attitude and atmosphere from mine, my sort of pace from mine. Mine was very downbeat and sort of, I wouldn't say miserable, because there was always at least some humor to it. But yeah, yours is much more upbeat and outgoing. I get the sense that you're an exercise, outdoors type of guy, much more than me at any rate.
A little bit. I actually, when you invited me on, because I know of you, I've seen you in many streams. I love that old one with you, Richard Spencer and Sargon. That's a classic. And I was thinking, what content did he make? I was like, I honestly drew a blank, and I found like old videos people re-uploaded. I thought, that's it. Blackout room, smoking cigarettes, and just shooting the shit about the world. And mine is a little bit a different style. I can have different kind of inspirations, just trying to, not really trying to reinvent the wheel, just try to be creative and try to, you know, just make something that's insightful and interesting.
So what are your inspirations? It's always a bit strange to ask that question, because people don't really consciously have a list of inspirations, but there do tend to be things that influence them and that crop up in their own work. So what would you say?
Well, when I was, you know, debating about the idea to make content, you know, just experiment, one of my friends is doing the same thing. He's started like a TikTok. He's doing kind of food review stuff, and he's taken a totally different direction, but we were just kind of, you know, following who we like. And initially I was following a gamer streamer. Have you heard of a guy called Synthetic Man? He's like a base. He's sort of a based kind of gamer guy online, and he makes kind of these videos about, you know, the sort of political subversion in modern gaming, which is an interesting topic, because gaming is, you know, I'm a big gamer, always have been, and I don't know if you've ever, you know, are you a big gamer at all?
Back in the day, but that's 30 years ago, so I don't think that's the kind of thing you mean.
But it's the same idea, right? Where gaming has been, you know, it's been early kind of, you know, it's only been bubbling in the culture since like early 2000s, but it became popular. But now, because it has become culture, you see the strands of subversion. So some of my earlier videos were about that, kind of mirroring similar things he said with my own kind of spin on it. And then I made a video that was kind of inspired by Devin Stack, Blackpilled. I know you've had him on. I like his videos. I came across him a few years ago now, and what I really liked, what he does, is when he looks back on those old school, you know, like old school documentaries, that are very, very interesting to look at, because even though they're maybe, you know, political propaganda in their own right back in the day, with our hindsight looking back on them decades later, you know, when their language wasn't as clever, when, you know, the sort of the language we hear wasn't as well established of what, you know, of the political subversion. And so I just thought they were very, very fun to watch, you know, and I kind of took a video. He did a stream on that. Have you seen that documentary? I think it was called Africa, Blood and Guts, 1960. It's spectacular. It's actually an Italian documentary, and there's like a British dub of it. And it's all about, you know, what happened when the British and the Arabs really kind of left Africa. And it was, it didn't go well. We'll say it that way. But the documentary was made in the 60s. So it's very interesting to see how they perceived that time. And so I've made a few other videos of that kind of ilk, not copying, because he does big streams. And I kind of thought my own kind of spin on it, where I will, you know, play kind of cool music in the background that I take from games that I like, that have a good kind of like tone. And then just my commentary on top of that, to, you know, just to add the nice bit of flair. I started a series actually on Thursday, where I found this very interesting 4-part documentary by the BBC, all about the Windrush. The documentary was made in the early 90s, I think.
Right. Okay. And but I remember hearing, the Windrush, the first time I heard about that was in the late 90s. And, you know, I wouldn't really have been quite cognizant of things in the early 90s, late night TV or whatever. But I do remember they made a thing about it in the late 90s. I remember there was this black poet, and they had him, he'd done this thing called Windrush Child. And he was a thing. For the BBC kept putting him up on air for a couple of years. But yeah, sorry, yeah, go on.
But yeah, because I didn't really know much about the wind. I knew of it, you know, I knew the kind of general themes of it. So a documentary made in the 90s about the Windrush, which was kind of late 40s, early 50s. And I just kind of take it apart, you know, and I think it's a lot more interesting about these older documentaries than the newer ones, because the newer ones are very, if anything, I don't think it'd be as interesting, because they're very easy to kind of take apart. They use the kind of, lack of a better word, you know, cultural Marxist language, the isms and all that sort of stuff. So looking back on, they're presenting the Windrush as a good thing in the 90s, lacking the sort of, you know, leftist language we hear today. It's a lot more eye-opening, and the kind of the with our hindsight, it's a lot easier to expose just, you know, how much of a lie and how much we were, you know, subverted with these ideas.
Yeah, and in retrospect, you can see what this stuff in the 90s was building towards, because we know what it ended up with 20, 30 years later. And it's the same with stuff from the 80s and 60s. Yeah.
It's like, yeah, you want to go back to the 90s? The 90s were still gay. That's one of the things he says, which is very, very true.
It's true, but it was... Right. I mean, that is true, but at the same time, it's also true that it was still objectively better than today. So I remember seeing him say that on Twitter, and I thought, I didn't bring this up with him just because it didn't come up. But yeah, of course, things weren't perfect in the 90s, but it was objectively better. I mean, you know, daily life was just more relaxed, laid back. People weren't uptight like they are now. They just weren't. I mean, you were far more free to say things than nowadays.
Yeah, just when you see those old video, like old VHS like videos of like American high schools of the 90s, and just think the, you know, what's that classic meme? You know, the world that you grew up on, doesn't exist anymore.
I've seen a few of those. Someone took a camcorder to a 7-Eleven in like 1988 or something, and everyone's just so chill and relaxed, and not like they're stoned. It's just that social interaction was much more fluid then. It's like people knew how to get along with a stranger at the 7-Eleven, whereas now there'd be far more of a screen up far more paranoia. And it's actually amazing when you see direct examples of the past like that, and that American high school one as well, you realize you realize how much stuff has changed, even daily life, even the way that we interact has.
Well, you almost have no business actually interacting with people. If I was to walk up to someone in the street and ask a question, whatever their answer is, I can probably find it on my phone, you know, the time, a direction, you know. I've got no business asking anybody anything. So when you do approach somebody, the only interactions I have with people, you know, in the public is when I'm walking my dog. You know, people love dogs. If I'm on the bus, headphones are off, because the dog will stir up conversation.
Maybe we should all buy dogs. Maybe that's how we can solve this.
I've never been much of a dog person till we've got the dog I've got. And it's a good character judgment. You know, when people, I don't necessarily expect everyone to, you know, pet the dog. But if the dog like comes up to sniff somebody and someone like turns their nose, you just immediately think there's something not quite right about that person. And from experience, I mean, do you have a dog?
No, I don't. Well, but I'd like one. Well, I get more and more.
Well, one thing I've noticed is when I'm on the bus or walking past any kind of like a, let's just say, non-white people. Despise dogs, absolutely despise dogs. Maybe like 1 in 10 quite like it, but the majority just despise it, and that just, you know, puts a bad taste in my mouth.
Interesting. Now, I've heard other people say this, and I've never, yeah, I can't remember ever seeing, you know, dog walkers who weren't white. You know, pet owners, it seems to be, and I'm sure you, someone watching this, could pull me apart for this and say I know 5 non-white people who have got dogs and cats, but in general it really does seem to be a white thing, and this has been reported. People have said this, it's been reported that, you know, white people are simply more empathetic and enjoy animal and possibly also the animals sense that in us and are more trusting towards us. I don't know if that's true or not, but I've heard it postulated. I don't know if we want to talk about Scotland yet. I think we should.
The most let's country get, in Europe.
Yeah, and a lot of people won't quite understand that and the reasons for it. I've got different explanations, but we'll get to that. But first, let's talk about your own background. So you went to university and became a wage slave. Do you want to talk about that, so that people have a sense of your background?
So 2013, went to university. You know, it was kind of the classic kind of, that's just what you do. Apparently, it was just a way to me to kind of get out the house. The kind of advice I was told was the sort of generic kind of advice. No, it wasn't bad intent, but it was the do what feels good. And what felt good was just hanging out, playing games and smoking. You know, that was it. So I went to uni. This is embarrassing. I got a degree in international politics. You know, I went through the social science kind of pseudoscience bullshit. But that, it was interesting because I went in 2013, you know, when Gamergate happened. So my kind of like journey was over all of this. By second or third year, I realized it was just a waste of time. You know, I misjudged the reality of the world.
Were you told that you wouldn't really be able to get a good job unless you had a degree? That was all this wisdom. I was 10 years earlier.
Yeah, it was more of just, you know, you go to uni, and then job opportunities will just kind of fall out of the sky. You know, I didn't necessarily not believe it. I didn't put much attention into it. Really, I didn't have much kind of foresight into what I really wanted to do. I still really don't. I just thought, if I'll do this and something will, you know, something will figure itself out in life. Got to kind of third year, realized what I've done is something very impractical, something not very worthy of any kind of merit. You know, if I was to interview people, which I have done in my previous job, if they were to tell me they got a degree in social science, that makes me, I would pay them to like not touch any of the computers at that point. You know, it's a red flag in my book. But but once in third year, I thought I may as well finish it. You know, I know I don't have a plan B. So I thought I'll just continue. I'll get my degree. And I guess only upside of that is you know, that kind of mantra you hear of like, oh, trust the experts, you know, you listen to, you're not an expert, you don't have a degree. Well, I do have a degree in this fake pseudoscience bullshit. So if I'm, you know, arguing with somebody online, you know, you just call them a fat retard and say, I'm the expert, I've got a degree in this made up field. But after that, what do? I get a job in Nando's in my first kind of job after uni. I had some kind of shitty other jobs during uni, but I needed to, you know, get a place to live. So I worked in Nando's for a year. And for the American audience, Nando's is a fast food grilled chicken place. And it's all right. I wouldn't go there if I wasn't working there, you know, because you can make your own lunch, steal things. It's really good. Then after that, got a job in a bank. That was really shit. I worked through there during COVID, so I stayed there longer than I should have. And then I quit that job with having no job lined up. I just thought I'll quit. You know, that kind of idea of putting your back against the wall because you're in a comfortable hell and you want to just escape, but you can't. So I just thought if I quit, that will force me to find a job. And then, so I remember going to the job center. I'm unemployed. I need free money. And then literally a month later, I went, I've got a job. And they were like, what the fuck? That never happens. And I got a job taking 999 calls, like as like a 999 emergency operator. So I did that for like 8 months or something. And it was the first job I took quite seriously. I wanted to kind of, actually, I want to see where this goes. So I was quite pally with the manager, you know, kind of, you know, mingling around. And then I managed to get a job as a manager in that site. So I was actually managing people taking these emergency calls, which is good fun. So that was probably the most kind of fun job that I had. It was very involved. I felt like I was doing something real, but it was only a secondment, you know, meaning I'm still actually like a level one slime, if that makes sense. You know, I don't actually have the job. I'm actually just doing the role, but as an advisor. And then because they kind of, they cut staff or people leave all the time, and you burn through a lot of staff as well. I probably fired like 5 people just for being retarded. And eventually I just had to move role because I knew I would be back to taking calls because my team was being dissolved essentially. Through no fault of my own, I'll put that there. And I would say my now job, but actually my last day was yesterday. I've quit. I thought I've thrown the towel to that. So I did that for 2 years. I worked for like a telecom company, dealing with their like high level executive office complaints. It was just bullshit. I heard you talking about like AI earlier in the previous chat.
Yeah.
You don't want to be talking with like AI robots. It's a step up from talking with Indians. Trust me. It's like,
Everyone's saying this now, like in America, in Canada, and in Britain, you hear this from everyone is suffering this plague of Indians where they just seem to have swarmed in. And I don't know, maybe they're doing the customer support from India, but they're all over the place.
Yeah, they've as a means of the cost cut, they just put lots of jobs offshore. And and it's not even the customer, just customer service. It's very technical jobs that are being offloaded, and it's just a disaster. And I was doing that for a while, and going back to what I was saying at the start, you know, I'm planning to do a bit of traveling with the missus. So my plan was I'm going to get like sabbatical. I'll work up until kind of like February, March time. Do our traveling, however that'll be, 3 to 6 months, who knows, really. We're just kind of play by ear. And but then I was off ill for like a week, and I came back, and what I had to deal with, the backlog, I just thought, fuck this, I'm just going to quit now instead. Not even sabbatical, just fuck it. And I feel really relieved. You know, I thought it'd be kind of, you know, I'm jumping the gun, or I'm maybe taking it, you know, I'm going too far, but I'm very happy that I've actually just left. And as I said, yesterday was my last day. So this is the celebratory quitting my job stream. So it's very, very good.
Right.
But so, and I've got nothing really to lose because I'm going to be traveling. So I'm not going to be working anyways. So what I've been doing is, well, this channel, it's been a lot of fun, it's creative, and whenever I kind of get into something that I'm really enjoying, I want to kind of go all in on it. So I want to just, you know, make better videos, make longer videos, make more videos, do streaming, test that out, just mess about, be creative and see what sticks. And again, if it doesn't work out, what I've managed to learn and experience and do within that time frame, it was going to be worth it. Because the videos I make now, I'm very limited in the time that I have to make them. Like I'm not at the point where I can, like behind me is my girlfriend's desk. I can't like record a video when she's like around. It just doesn't, I haven't quite got over that yet. It's a bit too awkward, you know, repeating yourself and doing things again and again. So my kind of like schedule of making a video would be, for example, the documentary I just covered. Let's say I watch the documentary Saturday, take notes on it. And then the Thursday, I'll do the recording before I start working. If I'm working from home, I'll do a recording before I start my shift of the video. Do the one take. That's what I have to go with. And I'll just edit the video as I'm working and get it published by, you know, 2, 3 p.m. that day. I'll just churn it out in like 10 hours from watching to then making it. So now I have this like almost unlimited time to just experiment and, you know, be creative and, you know, go to the gym more and just focus on me. You know, 10 years of wage slaving, you know, it's probably nothing to anyone, but, you know, I want to try and, to quote, what was his face, Andrew Tate, escape the matrix. That's the plan.
Well, on that note, what about your politics and your, what you said in the notes was your red pill journey. Mm-hmm. How did that, I mean, we can, I think in the course of this, we'll end up talking about Scotland and the state of affairs there, but let's try initially to keep this focused on you. Mm-hmm. How did that begin? Were you in the first place a typical Scot, you know, liberal, atheist, left wing? What, or were you something else from the start?
Yeah. That's the perfect archetype. That is it. I was maybe like 15, 16. My parents were very staunch, sort of atheists. And, you know, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris had the books, loved watching, even when I was still in like high school. You know, those like Hitch Slap, you know, Christopher Hitchens owns like, you know, Crazy Christian. That's what I love, that shit. Sam Harris as well. But those videos were, sorry, you've thing made there. You still hear me?
Yes.
That's fine. Yeah. So like, yeah, Sam Harris was, you know, I know he's kind of, you know, Trump derangement syndrome guy now. He's like, can't take him seriously. But what he said kind of stuck with me in terms of like Islam. You know, that kind of made me realize there is actually distinct groups that are, cannot be, you know, what's the word, where they can't settle the differences. You know, Western civilization.
And reconciled.
That's the one. We couldn't really reconcile these differences. And that kind of stuck with me. And that's called kind of really where I went from, you know, before university. Went to university to do my fake degree. And I thought I would just, you know, learn from everybody. I thought, I don't know anything. I knew I didn't know anything. So I wanted to listen to everyone I could. So, you know, Young Turks, big fan of them back in the day. 2013 and 14 Sargon of Akkad, which is very different to 2025 Sargon of Akkad. And then that kind of journey up until probably when most people hit like 2015, 2016 with rise of Trump and Brexit, there was a sort of like shift with, you know, with like nationalism and sovereignty and what this actually meant to be, you know, I went to the classic sort of conservative libertarian-esque. And then after kind of late university, after university, you know, that's when things sort of to go off the deep end. That's when you discover BitChute. That's when you begin to look into certain other events, we'll say, of history. And then kind of like, I went into a lot of these things, kind of like how, you know, when you discover the flat earth sort of stuff, you laugh at it. You want to like expose it. You want to know what these people say. But then there's some things, you know, I'm not a flat earther, by the way. But there's some things you look into and you can't really back yourself out of. You're kind of like stuck in there. And a few things that really kind of cemented my worldview was discovering a few of those Jonathan Bowden speeches, which I've uploaded a few of those because I just thought they were very inspirational, very pivotal in my development. And surprisingly, one of them was actually watching a Joe Rogan interview with that Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson. He's like, Graham Hancock's that kind of journalist guy that talks about Atlantis and ancient civilizations. And I'm very kind of into that. You know, whenever there's like lore, yeah, like Warhammer or World of Warcraft or anything, I like to know, where did it all begin? Very into that sort of like aspect. So when it came to like human civilization, where did it all actually begin? And that kind of got me down a rabbit hole of prehistory, ancient civilization, stuff that happened before the flood. You know, where does civilization come from? How did human populations migrate? You know, and it all kind of ended up debunking the whole out of Africa theory, and just how, you know, these human populations are extremely separate. You know, there's been one of the things I learned from, you know, the human migrations, and I think it was a Robert Seffer video. Ever heard of Robert Seffer? He's kind of like a kind of a esoteric kind of guy. He talks about Atlantis and ancient civilizations and anthropopathology. He was saying, like, you know, sub-Saharan Africans, there's like a ghost gene where there's like 19% of like sub-Saharan African DNA that is not actually reflective in modern Europeans and Asians. And that made me think, well, there's no, you know, relation in that way. We are very, very distinct. And that leads you into the sense of, we are distinct, then we have to kind of protect ourselves. And then it's just kind of the rabbit hole of where we are today of, you know, we are a distinct people. Remigration now, please. And, you know, the basic stuff. I wouldn't say, I don't have anything too outlandish in terms of the modern political, you know, right-wing zeitgeist. I'm kind of like straight and narrow. I've got a few kind of like maybe differing opinions. I think things like colonialism was a bad idea, not in the sense that it was, you know, evil. I just think it was a bad idea giving people who don't have two-story buildings a written language or a calendar, you know, giving them electricity and machine guns. It's a bad idea, you know.
Yeah, there are some quotes to that effect, that you're advancing them. It's like Star Wars Prime Directive thing, isn't it? You know, don't interfere with them. They're too primitive. They will not be able to handle, no matter how well-intentioned you are, they won't be able to handle the stuff that you're giving them. And it'll just mess them up. Have you found that these views have caused you any trouble in Scotland? Because I'm sort of 10 years out of date with Scotland. I left in 2017. And even before then, I was, I was unemployed and, you know, all this. So for a long time, so I was not really in tune with other people of my own age, even. So it's kind of difficult for me to keep track of this. But each time I go back to Scotland, I notice it's visibly different. Edinburgh wasn't so bad the last time, I've got to say, but prior to that, every time I go, it's visibly demographically different. It's quite remarkable. So have you found that your views, or, well, first of all, your view, before you started your channel, how did friends react to, or did you just keep it secret? I mean, that you were watching Jonathan Bowden speeches and Murdoch videos, or how did people react?
Well, I've got like one of my friends from uni, he's kind of on the same wavelength as me, but like friends that I've known from like school, and really the people I would still be friends with, the people I've kind of known from primary school, secondary school, they are quite understanding. You know, I'm not the kind of the autistic type to kind of force down my worldview. If there was a sort of like disagreement or a certain topic coming up, you know, I would chime in my piece, but it was all kind of tongue in cheek. And I know that's not actually the norm. A lot of people would kind of have falling outs and relationships would break down through political disagreements. But I think just the way I know when not to, you know, I've got nothing to gain from like espousing certain beliefs at certain times. Because I think when I'm with certain friends, you know, you don't need, you know, there's certain people you can hang around with and you can just talk about complete bullshit. And while that maybe seem like a waste of time, it's nice just to kind of tune out. It's nice just to talk about just fucking nonsense, really. You know, and that's kind of what you enjoy from school. So I don't really need to be constantly being blackpilled, talk about being blackpilled, trying to red pill everyone around me. It's just, it's completely fruitless. And especially when in my jobs, you know, I would keep that very, very close to my chest. It'll be, there's no point. You hear people talk about, you know, the most retarded shit you hear, you know, the classic libtard nonsense. And, you know, I heard some guy in my old job, he was talking about someone he used to work with, and he was saying, oh, that guy, he was like, he's one of those stop the boats nutters. Just shut the, I needed to shut up and just crack on. And I, there was one thing actually, I remember piping up once to ask a question that was, you know, it was more of like, I pretended to be just very ignorant of it. One of the companies I used to work for, it was boasting that it was hiring, you know, we're celebrating that we hired 10% more, you know, people from the BAME community, which were from the non-UK people, black, yeah. How does it stand for again? The black minority ethnic.
Black and minority ethnic. Yeah.
So we're celebrating hiring more black people. And I was just like pretending to be ignorant. I said, doesn't that mean they're celebrating hiring less white people? And my manager was like, maybe, I don't know. I think it's fine. They just like totally just ignored. Yeah,
I'm sure it's fine somehow. Yeah.
Yeah, totally fine. So again, it's just not worth it. I mean, you can kind of read people from time to time, but I've never really been in trouble. I mean, my dad knows I've got the channel. I did tell him after like a few months. I mean, the videos I was making were kind of, you know, rudimentary, you know, early stuff. Anyone's first videos are a bit kind of, you know, I'm sure you made your first videos, you look back and think, fuck, that's cringe or whatever. But he was like, he's kind of a classic sort of conservative Tory. Like he bought Boris Johnson's book, you know, that sort of level. But he's like proud. I think he just likes that I'm making stuff. He's proud of me in that regard. He's even sharing it in the wider family chat. Said, don't fucking do that.
I was going to ask if it had led to anything like any questions at your work or people.
People at work know that because I mean I've got fuck all else to talk about, so I'll say, yeah, I'm doing YouTube and stuff. Well, what's the channel name? I just say it's politically related, so I will not tell anyone. And they seem to just understand that. They, you know, they read that in any way they want. No one's recognized me. That is, I mean, the channel's tiny. You know, it's 14,000 ish. The day I'll be recognized, I'll make a tweet about it. I'll post it in Telegram. I'll take a picture with the guy. Or girl, probably the guy. According to the analytics, it'll be a guy.
Yeah. My mind was to say, I think I was, my channel, it was like 7% of female subscribers.
And even then, that's questionable.
Yeah, they might be lying. Let's get to talking about Scotland then. I think most people are aware that Scotland is more left-wing than England. And England dominates internationally. People will think of Britain, they'll think of England.
Yeah.
So Scotland is kind of a separate story. And the way I see this, and the way I've seen it for about 20 years, and the first thing was the smoking ban, which I'm sure you won't remember. That was 2006 in Scotland. And I thought they're trying to outdo England. They're trying to because it's sort of seen as progressive. It's sort of seen as left wing, and it's definitely anti-traditional. I wouldn't put much confidence in that left right paradigm for that particular issue. But nonetheless, that was how it seemed to me at the time, and it seemed that Scotland was trying to be more modern and, you know, than England, and Ireland was the same. Can't remember when they got theirs, around the same time as Scotland, and I've thought that ever since, that Scotland tries to be more holier than thou than England in every possible way, and you get a similar dynamic with Canada versus United States, and New Zealand versus Australia. It's the smaller, less famous, less significant country.
The underdog.
The underdog, sort of trying to score one over its big brother. I'm using loose language here, but that you get the point. And I think Scotland definitely has that dynamic with England, where it has to do something. But so if the English are, if they've got immigration, then we've got to have immigration. If the English are racist, then we have got to be joyfully anti-racist and enjoy having new cultures here and be open new to Scots. New things and new Scots, exactly. So there's this sense that it's a holy mission, a moral mission, but also it's to get one over the English. And of course, you end up with this ridiculous situation where Scots will be anti-English and they'll be really sensitive about English, hearing an English accent, but they'll hear every other fucking accent under the sun and react joyfully to that. So it's okay to get replaced as long as it's not by the English, as long as it's by anyone else.
Yeah, that's that's kind of exactly the way I tell people as well, where, you know, the Conservative Party in England is essentially like a centre-left party in reality, maybe not economically in many ways. And so because that's already left-wing, but perceived to be the evil right-wing party of Scotland, just sees it as that's Margaret Thatcher, that's evil. We have to do the complete opposite now. And now we have the really sad reality that it's gone so far that the idea of Scottish nationalism has been inverted into a left-wing conduit. I mean, any nationalist party in Europe is the right-wing party, but Scotland seems to be the most uber left-wing party, apart from the Green Party, probably. So we have no, you know, we have no way out of it, really. And yet, as you said, it's very the anti-English sentiment is still so strong, and it's very, very sad and quite cringe in a sense, for lack of a better word, where they're still very vehemently fuck the English, and you know, just all, you know, and that's really going to be our stumbling block, because whatever the English do, we do the opposite. You know, the English fuck up their country, we have to fuck it up twice as harder, and that's you know, we're just in a downward spiral, and I don't really see much of a way out for Scottish politics, because I know Labour took a good chunk of the SNP majority in Scotland, but the SNP looks like it's going to be, I guess, coming back, because Reform can't really make that many gains. I think the Conservative seats in Scotland are actually the strongest ones in the UK. I just don't know. I just don't know if there's any way we can see light at the end of the tunnel. I was actually quite pro anti-independence, just because I just knew it'd be led by retards, and maybe it's kind of like Count Dankula says, you know, we need to go independent, things need to hit the fan, and then things can get good again, which is kind of like, I wouldn't say I'm an accelerationist in a way. I know things have to, I know things on a wider level have to get worse to get better, you know, the sort of cycle of time, the pendulum swinging another direction. We are in a decline, but there can be a resurgence back before we go back down. But I think voting for things to get worse is just a bad mindset to have.
Yeah, it's a depressing situation to be in, where where that's the best you can hope for. what I like to think is that the more diverse Scotland gets, the more immigration it has, the more ordinary people. I mean, this is what's happening in England now, and the more people will turn against it. That's what's happening in England now, and it's because of the Boris wave, which has also afflicted Scotland. I couldn't believe it when have you heard of a town called Tillicoultry?
I have heard of it because it's a brilliant name, but I don't think I've been through it.
Hardly anyone has. But I knew that town a long time ago because we used to go to a ski slope there. It's one of those artificial ski slopes. And anyway, I went back to it last September. It's the first time I'd seen it for 34 years, actually. It's incredible. And, well, back then it was 100% white. And probably up till about 10 years ago, it was 100% white. We drove through it at about 4 p.m., so the schools were out. And I think that about one in four kids that I saw was non-white. And I was just stunned. And maybe it was just a particular day. Maybe that's the demographics are nothing like that. But this was my impression at the time, last September. And Tillicoultry is, as indicated by your answer, not a significant town. It's got a ski slope. And that's it, really. That's the only thing, that's the attraction.
That is it.
Yeah. It's a rural, nowhereville town. And yet even it is certainly struck by diversity. It was astonishing. And so my point is that this change isn't slow. It's not going to take 50 years like it's taken for England. More than that, 80 years since Windrush. It's very rapid. And they're also placing them deliberately in these places that are so white, that aren't the inner cities. That's what they used to do. They'd end up in the inner cities.
Inner cities are full. I've been through Glasgow recently, and it's just a nightmare. There's a brand new JP Morgan building right in the centre of town, and outside it, it's this very, very long kind of bicycle rack, and it's always full. Not just every rack is filled, it's crammed, overfilled with bicycles, and every single bicycle has a Just Eat bag on it or an Uber Eats bag, and they stay in the hotel. I was looking it up earlier. There's a hotel across the street, so, and again, they've just been dumped there. They're used as this slave, it's the closest thing to slave labor, and there's just off the black market, and it is bad. I've been around Glasgow over the past several years, and it is getting noticeably worse. One of my friends stays in the south side, and it's pretty bleak in many ways. South side of Glasgow, it's really bad, then there's a really nice bit, then it gets really bad, then there's a nice bit again, it gets really, really bad again, and it seems to be this concentric circles of the white places where it's nice and very expensive, and then it's just Baghdad after that. It's very, very bleak. And I went to Falkirk, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I did I tried to do some IRL content. There was a Falkirk protest for a migrant hotel, because one of the migrants sexually assaulted a 14-year-old. So I thought, I'll go up, I'll just talk to people, kind of get a bit of experience and exposure, and just kind of, never been to one of these protests as well. So there's a multitude of reasons to go. And everyone's very, it's quite interesting, because everyone there is kind of your kind of age, but a bit older as well. So they know the government's, selling them short. They know they live in a shithole, and they know that dumping these people here at the same time is going to make things worse. And, they seem to be very much, on our side. They're not really, I guess, on the identitarian side of things, but I think they could be more easily persuaded, where I don't think it's even necessary to persuade a lot of the masses. All you really need is the top 15% who can actually do change and lead, and the remainder 85% will just follow it anyways. So the idea of changing the masses is just a waste of time. It's never gonna have a mass awakening. You just have to have a sort of political dynamic shift, and then everyone else will follow. That's really the key. It's easier said than done, though.
Oh yeah, if it was easy, people would be doing it all the time. It's difficult, but I do agree, it doesn't, 85% of them, yeah, it really doesn't matter what they believe. They don't really believe anything. They definitely don't believe anything with conviction and force. They're basically waiting for other people to sort the world out one way or another.
Some people who try to have conviction, just that reminded me of something there, where I made a video about somebody, I think it was two people. I don't know if you heard of a YouTuber called Jimmy the Giant. And then there was another YouTuber I did a video on. They're two kind of big kind of leftist kind of YouTuber guys. And they both made videos about how I escaped the alt-right pipeline. So these guys pivot themselves as, I went down the rabbit hole and I escaped it. And so I did a review of their videos in the same style I do. They play, I react, cool music in the background. And these guys never really go deep enough. They do not actually hold any real convictions to change their mind. They're essentially just set in their kind of ways. They do what they think is going to be cool, do what they're going to be accepted by others. And even if there's an inclination of what they're doing has a level of truth to it, they'll just back away from it as soon as it seems to be not going to, help them socially. And I think that's the long and the short of it.
Yes, absolutely. I also think that sometimes these are people who are depressed in their lives, and so they find something like our videos or our content because it speaks to them. Yeah, the world isn't the way it should be. The world is messed up. So it's actually an emotional thing. It's not that they want to analyze society and come to an understanding of it. It's literally just that they're feeling depressed. And then once that passes, they have no further use for this stuff, or they realize that, well, there are other ways to cure my depression. I can get a job, I can get a girlfriend, I can go out more, I can lift weights or whatever. So I don't need this, which would cost me in other ways. If I pursue this, they instinctively know it's going to cost me, and that's going to make me more depressed. So all of this is not really about the truth or coming to an understanding of things. It's literally about their feelings. And so then after the fact, they then think, oh, I was nearly tricked. I was nearly taken in by that poison, that brainwashing. Thank God, a lucky escape. I better warn other people about that. And really, we're talking about morons. I mean, they've just,
morons have got a million
just stumbled
views
on the truth. Yeah, but they've stumbled on the truth and they don't even realize it. Because they don't have enough analytical capacity to realize, that was documenting reality accurately. So,
well, I think it's the,
so they
the
just think it was some sort of trick.
Yeah, the truths are inconvenient. I remember saying to some friends, saying, I'm not that happy that I found, I think it's something Gavin McInnes coined. He called them hate facts. You know, there's certain facts you learn that people call, you know, racist or that's hateful, or there's, you know, who hurt you? Why do you think that? That kind of mentality. But it's like, you know, I don't really, it'd be magical if your worldview was true. We live in this kind of happy, clappy John Lennon sort of like style of reality. But then you realize that's not the case. And you realize that a lot of people believe that John Lennon, you know, we're going to be magical and happy together. So you kind of have to just, you know, that's where you become blackpilled. You realize everything's really fucked, actually. You know, and but yeah, it's these people just do what's convenient. And actually, one of the guys I covered, I think something you hit on there, you know, he got a girlfriend. He got a brown girlfriend. That was a big climax I was building up to in that video, going, you know, what made him change? And he got a brown girlfriend. I was like, well, there you go. He threw it all away.
Well, yeah, there are a few such cases. I'm not going to say many such cases, but it does happen where some nerd or sperg ends up with a non-white girlfriend. And so what's he going to do? Obviously, he's going to give up on those ideas because he's got a girlfriend now. Yeah. So again, the truth just doesn't matter. It's and the actual reality of what's going on in society just doesn't matter because he's got a sex drive and he has confidence problems or whatever. And this brown girlfriend solves those problems for him. So this is an unreliable narrator. This is someone who you would not want analyzing society because he's not capable of being impartial or rational. He's ruled by his emotion.
No, exactly. It's and again, that's just 85%. They would just turn 180 degrees again if it was convenient once again. So at the end of the day, these people's opinions are not that important. It's funny for me to cover them because I think it's interesting. And, you know, these videos get millions of views. Well, not my videos, but these videos of these people just spousing this bullshit. I mean, that Jimmy the Giant guy, he was talking about how, you know, he was going off the deep end because he was listening to Jordan Peterson and Andrew Tate. And I thought, okay, what comes next? What comes next? And I, that's really as far as it went. And now he is like a Green Party activist based in the UK, which, I mean, I know the Green Party in like the United States is bad, but I think ours is infinitely worse. I mean, we have a, you know, I guess I'll refrain from describing the party leader, but he's, you know, it's a Gates of Toledo situation. You know, it's like they actually went over to France to help people come into Britain who don't belong here.
Yes, it's unbelievable. He was saying that, I think he was filling the water tanks so that they could, you know, so that they could drink and be replenished for their journey to, you know, illegally get into Britain. I mean, it's the definition of a traitor.
Yeah, I have to kind of laugh at times like that. It's just like, it's just so blatant, and that's why it's just
it's kind of cartoonish.
I think everyone in our space, you have to kind of go through that kind of red pill rage, you know, when everyone loved those social justice warriors been owned by Ben Shapiro, you know, Ben Shapiro slam dunks, social justice warrior, Ben Shapiro bulldozes Palestinian village with facts and logic, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then you say, or that's what GB News does. Did you see what the left did now? But, you know, you have to get over that phase, and you have to kind of see, well, it's all fucked. What could we focus on? What can we be more positive in? I think that's what the movement needs, is more pro us, more, you know, optimism, even though it's hard to be that in that sense. It's just filled with people who are just so self-destructive and filled with despair, which I understand. There's elements, I understand why people feel that way, and in a way, many people should. But it's just not helpful if you're just like, you know, I think what Jonathan Bowden says, you know, these sort of emotions, you know, all it is multiply the misery that's already there. So it's just not worth focusing on, you know, being angry.
Oh, yeah. It's inevitable that, well, first of all, depressed people or lost people are going to gravitate to this kind of thing because it helps to make sense of the world. They'll gravitate to a whole range of other things as well, but one of them will be this stuff. But then this stuff will also tend to get people down because it is depressing. I mean, it is depressing to think that your society is being systematically destroyed. So, there is going to be a lot of that. And I try to work against that. I try to look for, especially nowadays, I try to be constructive and positive, because I think we have to be, because otherwise this stuff will swallow us. So I think it's important to try to be resourceful and strong.
And sometimes just taking a bit of time to not look at Telegram or Twitter, and just, you know, you don't want to wake up in the morning and immediately doom scroll to see, you know, some non-white violence against whites, and then some horrible story about the grooming gangs. And, you know, if you read that every single day, it's just, you know, things aren't going to change, and you need to kind of distance yourself from that from times, because it's just not healthy to be surrounded by that all the time. You know, one of my go-to getaways, apart from games, which I've not done in a while actually, is I would watch like wrestling from like 2000, 2001, you know, that kind of like glorious era where the world was simpler, pre-9/11, the world was different, and you kind of like, that's real, really good escapism. I don't know if you're like a fan of wrestling or anything like that.
No, but I can imagine what you're talking about. I've heard Academic Agent talking about this stuff, and he is very much into it, and he can remember all these famous face-offs between different wrestlers in the 90s and the 2000s. So.
Oh, it's cool. It's the evolution of the Greek theater. That is it. It's American wrestling is great. Although I don't watch anything modern. I just go back to, you know, The Rock, Stone Cold, all that sort of stuff back in the day. But you can only escape for so much, which, you know, it's which some people do through various means, so drugs, alcohol, and none of it's all that healthy. I mean, I've been through a phase where I was working my job at the bank, and I was just living the life as a student still, you know, working. But then I would just go home, I would just smoke, play games. And you think that's actually quite a fun way to live. But, you know, after like a couple of years, or a year and a half, you know, reality like bleeds in, you know, the real reality bleeds in. You realize what you're doing to yourself is actually very, you know, it's very destructive. And you realize you have to kind of make a change in life. But, you know, when people who are depressed, I wouldn't say I was depressed. I saw myself spiraling. I knew if I kept doing that, I would be in a bad way. And I thought, okay, there has to be changes. But the reason why I'm in this mess is because I've not made those changes. You know, you have to kind of make incremental changes. I knew that deep down, you know, because if I could just wake up tomorrow and change everything, I would have done it. And I didn't have the willpower, because that's how I got into that mess to begin with. And, you know, then literally after like 3 months of just trying to do some self-improvement, everything just turned around, you know. Quit my job, stopped smoking as much. And then that kind of phased out. Went to the gym, started eating well, sleeping pattern. That's like the trifecta of like sleeping pattern, eating, and just not doing drugs. That's literally all you have to do in order to kind of you know, ascend, really.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's so simple that it's annoying. Like, a lot of people will hear that and think, well, how do I get started? But really, it is just baby steps, isn't it? You've just got to do one of those. Just choose one of those and do it first.
Yeah, because it's not because you can't wake up tomorrow with the mindset of like a Royal Marine. Be like, I'm going to wake up and, you know, drink a green juice and run 5 miles. It doesn't work that way. You know, you're in this mess because you're not a Marine. That's the whole point. So yeah, as you said, baby steps, one thing at a time, focus on three things. If you can't do those three things, do two, then do one. And if you can't do one thing, then, well, fuck, it might be over.
Yeah. You said in your notes, self-improvement, overcoming apathy, weed, and ascending.
Yeah, it's kind of just what I kind of covered where... So were you going to ask something more specific there, or...?
No, I was going to ask if you wanted to say more about that, because I think that is useful. You seem to have quite a positive attitude, and I think a lot of people could probably do with hearing more of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was working after working from Nando's, I thought, I need to get a real job. I was working in Nando's for like 11 months. It was fun, good people, you know, it was a nice environment for hospitality. But then I got my job at the bank. It was just kind of, you know, I was just a phone monkey, you know, just the classic sort of shit. It was very tedious and unpleasant and monotonous. And so I just kind of, you know, got myself into a bit of a rut by just living, you know, through pure escapism. And it just went on and on for like longer than it should have, for one reason, because I was smoking a lot of weed. And two, then it kind of COVID happened as well. So it was kind of like prolonged in that kind of like state of purgatory. But then through meeting my now girlfriend, you know, I was like, well, if I'm seeing her a lot, you know, that's going to cut my smoking in half, and then I can slowly phase things out. Because one issue with like, if you're ever a weed smoker, it's if you stop, then what are you going to do with the time that you would have had if you were smoking? And it's kind of like, you know, it's hard to kind of like change that. It's more of a psychological thing. And I think that's, you have to do something with your time. I think that's the biggest issue of weed that's not spoken about. You know, I know there's all that kind of reefer madness stuff and people going schizo, which I think there's an element of that. But I think the main issue, the main thing people don't talk about when it comes to grass, weed, cannabis, whatever, it wastes time. It wastes your time. And how much time you actually waste when you look back on is incredible. I do have some good memories that I'll never, you know, want to, don't regret, with friends, you know, finding places to smoke, you know, going down the beach and just hanging out. It's a good social thing. But when it's something you do as a habitual behavior, repeatedly, daily, then it is very destructive because your life evolves around it. And it's just something that has to be tamed. You know, if you can't restrict yourself or have a good relationship with it, then you have to just cut it out. Because I've stopped for like years now. But then in the summertime, I went to the Netherlands. I visited my stepdad. And, you know, what's the expression? When in Rome, when in Amsterdam. You know, we had like a little smoke. And that was it, really. Had some smokes with some friends when I would come back. But that's it's just easy to kind of move past that. And one other thing, I don't know if you've ever like smoked a lot of weed back in the day. You ever smoke at all?
Not weed. I mean, I've done it. I do it like once or twice a year or less. You know, I think the last time was about 3 years ago now. Rarely.
One thing I wasn't aware of when you stop is your dreams become extremely vivid, like overwhelmingly vivid. Like you go to bed and you're thinking, I'm about to go on a fucking roller coaster here, you know, and you wake up and it's very... It's very interesting. I should probably have written some of them down because they were very, very bizarre and very kind of like, some of them would like kind of sit with you, and some of them would be like, I still remember how they would make me feel, and nothing weird or, you know, terrifying, but very kind of like, it's almost as if your subconscious has been subdued for so long and it's almost like trying to like tell you things again. And yeah, here we are. You know, I was one of those guys who, you know, I'm like 6'4", quite slim. And like, I was always told, you'll fill out eventually. Don't you worry. You'll fill out. You'll get a bit bigger. That's a fucking lie, by the way. To get bigger, you have to eat a lot of food and lift heavy pieces of metal over and over again. And so I've been kind of like doing a lot of the gym stuff. I did a lot of martial arts, and I think lifting weights is honestly like it's male therapy, you know, because you get good at lifting weights and it teaches you how to be good at something again. And it's just such a like, seems so simple, but it's like it teaches you also like progression, you know, in sort of like a, like I play a lot of World of Warcraft, you're like leveling up your character, but it takes fucking forever. It's kind of like that kind of element of it, you know, you have to just, it's results you have to work for, which is very important now where everything's very, very instant. You know, people want stuff now in front of them. And, you know, a lot of people can't even, it's no surprise people can't read books anymore. But I don't know if you've like spoken to anyone recently who's just brain dead by doom scrolling. They can't even watch a film. Have you heard that before?
I've heard about this.
I've met people who cannot watch films because it's too long and they can't pay attention.
That's just terrible. And I don't know what that points to. What kind of future is there where people can't sit? Like 90 minutes is too much. So what do they do? I mean, what's storytelling going to be in the future then for the masses?
15-second scrolls.
That's a scary thought.
Yeah. Well, the scary thing was the guy who told me that, I was actually managing him, and he was a 99 operator. So he's telling me he can't pay attention to watch a fucking film, and he has to pay attention all day to take emergency 99 calls. So I had to pay a close eye on him because I knew his brain was elsewhere, and it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been a danger that people have been talking about for a long time. I can remember in the 90s people talking about MTV editing, where things were really fancy and fast-paced. And it was, and it's only increased since then. And now you've got, well, the endless scrolling. It's something that changes non-stop. There's constantly a new tweet to look at. And this is why people can get addicted to Twitter, as I did at one point. But thankfully, I think I've established more self-discipline since then. And I think you have to. I think you have to be quite conscious of these dangers in order not to get sucked into it.
No, absolutely, because it is changing humanity it is changing our level of consciousness. You know, we are, this is why I feel like, you know, like Jonathan Bowden, I'm a kind of a modernist. You know, we are progressing in a sense where not just with technology, but our minds are changing to the world. And with all this technology, it's coming out very, very quickly. It is having an effect on our consciousness as a population, as a people, as a species. But because these things are very, you know, we don't really have an experiment. I mean, this phone, I mean, when people say things like, what are the effects of the mobile phone? It's really too soon to tell. We really do not know the actual effect on our psyche. And as you said, you realize some of it is quite negative because it's kind of out of our control in many, many ways. So we have to kind of, you know, find a way to have an actual healthy relationship with it. Otherwise, it'll probably destroy us. You know, I'm a big fan of like Ted Kaczynski, but I wouldn't go as far as him in the sense of it has to be destroyed. You know, we're only going forward in one direction, and that is we are with technology. And again, just to quote Bowden, you know, if the sort of texture and fabric of the texture and fabric of reality would be one way the same and every other way different if people like us had, you know, if we were kind of guiding how things were going, as opposed to, you know, our government who is now introducing, you know, these laws about, you know, adolescents and teenage boys, and, you know, Elon Musk, who, you know, he's kind of hit or miss in my book, you know, is a big autist, but, you know, I don't really know if he just wants to do things for the sake of doing things. You know, does Elon Musk and these scientists, you know, they do things just for their own gain. There's no real kind of altruistic kind of like thinking of what does this actually do for humanity, other than, well, this is cool, let's see what happens.
Yeah. I think that is a really interesting Bowden quote, and I have heard it before. I think I might have heard him saying it, that we would, immigration would be completely different, the demographics would be completely different, but in every other way we would still have the problems of modernity, and the main one being technology and new technologies that we just don't know how to interact with and what effect they're going to have on us. And I think that you're right, that I mean there are people, including people I've had on Millennial, who want all of this to go away, and or at least want to eschew it themselves. They understand that everyone else is going to use AI and whatever, but they just want to completely go without it. And I think that I can understand that, and I'm sympathetic to it. And broadly, I don't use AI for not nearly as much as everyone else seems to be using it now. Mm. But I also accept that it's never going to go away. I mean, this is it now. It's here. It's never going to go away. So we have to, if not make peace with it, we have to find some way to accept it and deal with it.
Yeah, it has to be embraced on many levels, because as you said, if you don't use AI, you know, and everyone is, you know, it's hard to have a, not necessarily have an opinion, but if you are kind of unable to keep up with the times, then you're just going to be left in the dust. You know, the equivalent is, which we won't see now, is, you know, when you see pensioners and they can't use a smartphone, which is fair enough, but the equivalent of that will be if people just say, fuck it, I'm not going to do any of this stuff. You will simply not be able to actually live a normal life. You'll be disconnected from what is actually happening, because what's happening is online. You know, the online sphere is almost like, you know, telepathy. Everything, in a way. Yeah. It's leveled up our consciousness to be in communication with everyone all the time, you know, everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Another aspect of this, which is even more profound, is genetic engineering. And apparently the Chinese are doing, I mean, it's always this myth about what the Chinese are doing. That's been going back decades. But apparently the Chinese are looking into genetic engineering so that they'll have high IQ kids. They'll make sure that I don't know if they're literally going to do this, but it's conceivable, no pun intended, that they will literally make sure that every child has an IQ of at least 105, let's say. And then 50 years from now, at least 110, etc. Well, if they're going to do that, and yes, of course, you can talk about the dangers of a smaller gene pool, narrowing it down, whatever. I'm sure that's factored into it. They're not retarded. But if they're going to do that, and we're going to stay at an average of 100, then at some point they could just crush us. And so the question is, do we have to embrace this? Not because it's fashionable, not because it's beneficial, not because it's cool, not because it's new, but because it's literally necessary in order for us to survive. Mm-hmm. It's essential. Could it become like that?
Yeah, we should bring in more Somalians. That'd be really good for our average IQ levels.
Oh, I know. That's the thing. While the Chinese are doing that, we're doing this. And I think I've seen studies where they talk about the average IQ seems to be going down compared to 50 years ago. And it's like, well, what do you expect? Of course it is. You're bringing in huge numbers of people. I mean, I almost feel guilty.
Well, maybe the one benefit is
kind of like, we're talking about, but
maybe the benefit of that is when people who commit crimes, they're no longer going to be regarded as too low IQ to not be prosecuted anymore. That seems to be the go-to strategy, which I always thought quite funny. You know, if you see someone like a crazy African with an IQ of like 65 killing somebody, and then it says so they're too low IQ to be punished for it, essentially, you know, my inclination was I thought the justice system was to keep these low IQ psychos off the streets to begin with. You know, if like that, to me, that would make you think that's probably more of a warrant to actually put this person away forever or chuck them in the sea.
Before they've done something. I don't know. I mean, exactly. Before they've done something, that's where you actually do need pre-crime. If someone's got an IQ of 65, I do not want him on the street. Because, I mean, God knows what he could do. Yeah, if I look at him in the wrong way, you know, who knows what could happen? And that goes for everyone, every woman, every girl. Who knows what a guy with an IQ of 65, 70, 75, I mean, that's pretty much fucking retarded.
Yeah, because I remember something that Morgoth wrote about, like, I don't know if you saw that Substack or video he did about the Myra Hindley and Ian Brady and the Moors murders, and, you know, what we see back then Have you watched these sort of true crime kind of documentaries now of, you know, when the guy kills his wife and it's, you know, he's very kind of secretive and he has this plan. It's all very kind of like there's intrigue and it's mysterious and this guy's kind of like gone off the deep end. But now we just see this sort of barbarism and pure savagery where it's like there's no explanation. It's just like, you know, regarded as, oh, you know, it's just a crazy guy, you know, who rams down three people in Nottingham or...
you know, well, the media want us to believe that there's no explanation. It's just mysterious that this just happened. And they want us to get used to this idea that this stuff just happens now. Mm. There is an explanation. When that guy in Yorkshire killed 10 kids 50 years ago, that was mysterious. When some guy with an IQ of 70 does something today, that's not mysterious. We all know why it's happening. It's a game that the media play to get us to think that this is somehow mysterious.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. It's just, again, it's just sort of the media cycle. And, you know, people who still watch the news, you know, they're very much... One thing I used to do at work when I was just kind of wasting time trying not to do my job was there's like a website like MSN where it will kind of like give, you know, all the kind of headlines and different news stories from different like news sites. So I would just like click on the comments to see who the fuck is actually commenting on this like mainstream kind of website. It's just obviously boomers and normies, and it's not. I mean, that's blackpilling. Read these comments. That's very blackpilling to see what people are arguing about. People who could be quote unquote on our side are just so, you know, far off from really understanding anything. And it's just a revolving door of people just very, very misunderstood.
Yeah. It's the famous boomer Groundhog Day where they seem to grasp something new and then the next day they're just back to it. But I don't want to dwell on this, but I am curious, morbidly curious. What kind of comments do they come out with on these news stories?
I mean, what's the sort of tenor? I mean, yeah, just sort of stuff like, I can't really think of anything off the top of my head, but just trying to think of a story like... it's hard to kind of like pinpoint anything because you just kind of read it and just have to scroll through, but you can deep dive yourself of just, you know, comments or
Is it that sense that they've just got no idea what's going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's mindless. It's just it's the NPC hive mind.
Yeah. I've seen similar things, and this is one of the reasons I stopped reading the comments under newspaper articles, because it's mainly boomers who do it. And they just have no clue. I mean, I know some of them do, of course, but they're not on the newspaper websites. They're on Twitter or whatever.
I think my dad is slowly starting to kind of not really wake up in a way. She said that boomer Groundhog Day, it's kind of like they will forget. But, you know, I've told him and we've kind of spoken about many, many things, but he's like, well, you know, I'm retired. This is just not my problem anymore. You know, he's got that kind of mindset where he's like, I'm just going to go to Lanzarote and chill out on the beach for a while. This is just beyond me. And in a way, he's right. You know, he's done the race. You know, he can just chill out, and he knows it's my fight, or, you know, the generations after me. You know, he was born in 61, so he's had that kind of good time, the last kind of bastion of being able to, you know, do what you want that feels good, and then still make, you know, enough money to have the house and the car and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah, I know exactly the type. My own parents were just a few years older than that. And they did have a good time. And I don't want to denigrate them, because they did have to work hard. You know, people always say this about the boomers, that they had it easy. You know, that's not exactly true. But what they did have was stability in the country that we just don't have. I mean, they knew the career path. They knew what to do.
That's the main point. If they know, if they work hard, they're going to get that kind of like end result. Whereas I know if I was to stay in my job and be there forever, those people, I mean, again, this is a sign of the times. There's people who are doing the exact same job as me, but because they were hired during, you know, economically better times, they're earning 20 grand a year more than me. So I'm brought in as like the sort of wage slave jockey, expected to do the exact same standard of work for how many years. I mean, if I was to like change job in that role, everything's very horizontal. There's no real, you know, lateral, or, you know, there's no real movement upwards anymore unless you're going to management, and everything's sideways. If you get a new job, it's going to be paid the same, even if it's of a higher caliber to do. And you know, the idea you'll have to work for another 30 years, get a pension. I mean, a pension is, I've seen too many things about the, you know, the idea of we'll have a pension when I retire. It's just not going to be there. The money's going to be worthless, yeah. And it's going to be over. So that's part of a big way of me wanting to actually, you know, at least attempt to do something creative that can maybe lead to down the road something that doesn't involve me going into this office 5 days a week. And one of my friends said, when I was debating about making videos, it was like, well, you've got a choice. Either you risk being a little bit cringe, or you wage slave for 40 years. So I thought, I think I'll risk being a little bit cringe and put myself out there, because I'm quite an introverted kind of, I'm very personable, get along with people, but you know, I can just sit in silence and not have to worry about what other people are saying. And you know, it's quite a big effort for me to get on a stream or, you know, record myself or, you know, do things like this. It's all very new. I never had any experience making videos or anything until like this time last year. And sorry. And yeah, it's been more achievable than I thought.
Can you remember the first time you talked to a camera? Because I can, and it was so strange. It was so weird.
Yeah. It was, for me, it was that Rome video. I made a video about right. Ancient Rome and shit. You know, that kind of meme, like, why are men thinking about the Roman Empire? I put my kind of spin on it, and I was trying to, hold on, bear with me, I need another drink of water. Can you bear with me a sec?
Yeah. I'll play the NFT trailer.
The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.
There we go. So I've just filled in my nice big bottle of Lucozade. right. What were we saying just before, like talking into a camera?
Very strange. And I've still got the footage of me doing it, and it was so you talk about cringe. That's the only time when I think, bloody hell, I seem so stilted and unsure of what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah, it's just very unnatural. It's also,
it is, because there's nobody there, but you're talking as if there's someone there. But the funny thing is how quickly you get used to it. I remember, you know, it didn't take that long, you know, half an hour or something. And then you get over that barrier. But yeah, we should do the super chats and then and then wrap up, because I think we've gone through quite a lot there. And I did think that we would talk more about Scotland. I expected there'd be more to say there, but I think our experiences have been quite similar in that it's almost like there's not much to say. It's like, it's just, they just need to suffer. And there's a lot of suffering that needs to happen before the Scottish people are going to have an inkling of what's going on and what's been going on in England for decades.
One thing I'll say just before the super chats is very quickly is, you know, when making content, you have to be interesting. And I figured I'm interesting enough, have enough to say. And the barrier of being interesting or insightful is very low. I mean, someone like Lex Friedman has the most popular podcast out there. You know, he's very popular, isn't he? And he's
but he's astroturfed.
He opens his mouth and it's just a vacuum of atmosphere. And a big shout out to Murdoch. You know, one of my videos did well, and I know we didn't get to talk about that much, but you know, they're a big kind of inspiration. And you know, thanks very much to them for reaching out and helping out the channel. And we'll have some more successive Murdoch content on. If it's anything footage-wise, it'll be in Rumble. But I'm going to do their do his book as an audio book in the near future.
Right. Yeah, we should have talked about that. I mean, Murdoch need no introduction. Everyone watching this will be familiar with them. Their videos were a huge part of the scene. I think from 2015 or 16 onwards, I can't remember when I first saw Murdoch video, probably 2015. And then they disappeared. And it's they sort of documented the alt-right and its development. And I loved their stuff. And I knew, and I know that they liked my stuff, because I remember them once saying, they said complimentary things about me in one of their AMEs. So that was nice to hear. There was a really nice AMA. I didn't see that, no. It was years ago.
There's like a new AMA if you've seen this. It's on my Rumble. It's like 4 hours long, so it's a good cozy listen. They do get wasted about half an hour in, though.
But their stuff always had this. It was abrasive and controversial and shocking sometimes in what they'd show or say. I remember one time the storyline was that they were visiting Britain and London, and they showed Sadiq Khan shitting on a streak on the car. I remember bursting out laughing when I saw that. But yeah, it was controversial, but there was always a warmth about it. There was always a human heart to it, and it wasn't nihilistic. In fact, it seemed almost like it was an attempt to escape nihilism, like to find a way to care about the modern world and to be okay.
Well, absolutely. That was the main reason of his book. You know, there's like escaping nihilism and that sort of stuff. And have you ever watched the cartoon Recess? It reminds me of that in a way, where everything ends in a sort of moral and ethical lesson to take away for the audience to kind of feel better about themselves and how to move forward in the world. So no, it's just absolutely, it is some of the best right-wing content to ever exist. I don't think it can be actually topped. It is just brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. And it's a perfect example of how, if we weren't being suppressed, we would be, some of us at least, would be huge, would be very successful in what should be the mainstream media. But because of that, we exist on these, well, first on YouTube, and now many of us not even on there. All right, let's get to the super chats. Okay, this is from Soaker City. Old Sterling, you must pitch a video game to Woz. A video game allows the mind some rest and solace from the intensity of modern life. I'm still playing Red Dead 2, Doom Eternal, and going between Warhammer and Endless Legend 2. One can still read, of course, but games are enticing. You don't need to follow his advice there. Video games for me are like drugs. I know that I would get addicted if I did very long, and so I don't want to get into it. So that's my attitude. But Soaker City obviously approves of video games to some extent.
It's good escapism. Everyone needs some sort of escapism. I think Nick Fuentes said, you know, people are like, throw away those video games. He's like, that's all we fucking got left. That's it. So,
yeah, it's true. Everyone needs escapism. And I've got my own things. You know, I like old TV dramas. Okay, Lars said, you did the Murdoch Q&A. We need to get them back in the game, willingly or not. What you'd have to say.
He did reach out again after the AMA, maybe like a week or two ago. He's, you know, happy with the AMA, and, you know, hopefully we'll stay in, you know, broad communication. He sent me like an idea of like a series where we maybe like he'll recommend a book, I'll read the book, then we review the book. I'll go in blind. So he's recommended a book. I've ordered it. I've forgotten what it's called, which is probably better, so I don't spoil it. So we'll see. I think it's about spiritual journey in some way. Fuck knows. I'm just going to go in blind, and we'll just kind of go from there. And you know, everyone loves Murdoch content. He likes to use the channels and means to kind of communicate with his audience again. And well, hopefully they kind of, I don't know what their personal situation is, but hopefully they can, you know, come back in some way. I don't expect them to make stuff again, but people love who they are, and, you know, hopefully they can continue to engage with the people who have loved them for so long.
Yeah. Claude says, old Sterling rules. Found you through my friend Carl Dead Internet Despot, watching your videos on his streams. I loved the Jonathan Bowden speeches you posted. Any serious person in right-wing or nationalist politics needs to listen to those speeches. Bowden was way ahead of his time. Thanks for doing that.
There'll be more speeches to come. I posted the one what he did on Nietzsche. That was the first one. That's my favourite. And the second one was on Julius Evola, who that got me into traditionalism. And I went down the sort of esoteric kind of rabbit hole. And that's kind of helped shaped my worldview in many, many ways.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I could talk about the Bowden speeches. You know, it's... Somebody contacted me about 2 years ago saying that they had recordings of many more speeches that aren't available, aren't released, and they were all in old camcorder tapes. But then I heard no more from that person, so I'm hoping that it was a hoax in the first place. It's not the case that these tapes got somehow lost. That'd be a tragedy. Mm. Okay. Ethno-nationalist says, "What was an old Sterling? What is your favourite Murdoch episode?" Well, I actually think the one about Sargon, and not because it was not because of any beef that I might or might not have with Sargon, but I thought it was incredibly well done, and they did it in a matter of days. Like it was amazingly fast, and I thought that the grasped it quite well of what was going on there.
Did that come out as a turnaround from the debate you did, or with Spencer?
Yeah, yeah.
That's like a South Park turnaround when something happens and they just get it done in the week. That's really good.
It was amazingly fast, and I also thought it was touching. I mean, it was funny and hilarious, but also touching. So that's my favorite one.
Mine is Race Jam. That's the basketball one. Yeah, that's a brilliant.
Oh yeah,
There's so many, because every character has such a good part in it. You know, Murdoch Chan's got a good bit. Arthur Donald, my favorite character. Jordan Peterson, William Pierce, they've all got great, great parts in that episode.
Yeah, I remember that. Let's see, where was I? Oh yeah, Soccer City. This has been a highlight of Millennial for me. Thank you both. Untold love and respect. Thank you very much, Soccer City.
Thank you. 07.
Okay. Claude says, so if you don't need a university degree to get a good job, what do you do or where do you go to get a good job? A trade? Please be specific. Thank you. This stream has been great so far.
I mean, personally, I would say if you have an idea of what you want to do and it needs a degree, then do it. If you have like a STEM or a lawyer, that's the path. But if you just want to fuck around and do a social science, unless you know it's going to lead to a certain role, then you're just wasting time, unless you know exactly what you want to do. Trades, I don't know anything about trades. I mean, that could be worth doing. But I think really, if you want to just do work, I think it comes down to just having experience. You know, if I went into work when I was 18, rather than, when did I leave uni? 21. So I would have had, how was that, 3-4 more years of working experience. You know, you could be a lot further on in your career path rather than wasting 4 years. I wouldn't call it wasting because I had good times. You know, it was just like I knew it was the last time I would be free, properly free. So I just milked the fuck out of it, you know. But it was third year and I thought, I should do something else or I should find a job. I thought, no, this is it. I have to enjoy this. And I did. I had a great time. Mm-hmm. Never pay that student loan back.
I tried to, and I called them up, and they didn't know who I was. They couldn't find my record. So I don't know. I don't understand.
It used to be taken out of my payslip, but then it just stopped. So I just ignore it, and I don't even know what it is. It's I think the way the Scottish do it, it's just free money. So, you know, it's their responsibility for being so foolish and giving it to me in the first place.
Yeah. In terms of getting a job, what I would say is, this is something that I was never told at school. And I don't think that they tell you this. It's who you know, not what you know, really, most of the time. And even once you've got a degree, even in fields that require a degree, you will still need to be socially adept and good at networking, good at getting along with people, being reliable, having a good reputation.
That's it. That's how I got the job as the manager. Because I thought, I'll befriend my manager, I'll be pally with them, I'll get on, I'll perform well, I'll turn up in time. And then 8 months, I which is unheard of in that kind of role. All of a sudden, I'm managing a team that is in charge of trying not to kill people. So,
you know,
befriend someone more powerful than you. Get a mentor.
Yeah, and just be outgoing, especially when you're young. Be sociable. Understand that really the more social connections you have, the more options you will have, mm-hmm. and the more there will be people who can help you and assist you and so on. So don't ever think it's about the qualifications that I've got, and I've got those, so I don't need anything else. You need this more than you need the qualifications in most lines of work, I would say. But then that's my perspective. I'm not as experienced as some people in this stuff, but I think it's common sense. And it's stuff that is not told to you at school. They'll tell you, you just need the qualifications, and it's not true. Okay. Right. Okay. The Wanderer asks, what's your favourite Bowden speech?
That one I first posted, the one about Nietzsche, which when you listen to it, he mentions it's about Nietzsche, but he just kind of goes on a tirade and really kind of unloads his kind of philosophy of the world. And I think it's such a great speech because he is not a Christian, but Christians can listen to it. Pagans can listen to it. Atheists can listen to it. There's so much to take away from different kind of spiritual lenses because it's so valuable and applicable in many ways. It's almost like a perennialist speech, if that makes sense, where it just encapsulates everything in such a concise, beautiful way. And even just the way the speech sounds, it has that kind of like echo of a hall. And it is just magnificent. I would say that when I listen to that, that really kind of, I listen to it going, this makes sense. You know, this is kind of my worldview that I kind of had in the back of my mind. This spelled out to me in a 50-minute speech. And yeah, the Evola one, as I said, equally as good, not as powerful, but it definitely put me down the rabbit hole of understanding traditionalism and really deep diving that.
Yeah, it's a long time since I listened to Bowden's speeches, but I did listen to a lot of them, and I remember being especially struck by his one on T.S. Eliot. I really enjoyed that one, so that's what sticks in my mind.
Yeah, I've got a speech actually, one that somebody published of all of his speeches. This one, Bowden.
Oh yes, and yes.
Reactionary Modernism is kind of like a list of, or not a list. It's kind of somebody's transcribed his speeches, so. That's quite
cool. I helped to do that, actually. Greg couldn't understand some phrases. Yeah. Yeah. It's that was from old recordings. And so, because he was just improvising everything. So,
yeah,
he never had a script. Amazing. Amazing orator. All right. Dardy said, the first time I encountered Sterling was a YouTube recommendation from one of his Murdoch videos. It had about 50 or 60k views, and I figured it must just be a leftist or bread tuber bitching and moaning about racism. Was pleasantly surprised when I got taken on a total nostalgia trip. I didn't think channels like his still existed on YouTube. Well, don't attempt the fates, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like, well, are you on YouTube much? How do you think? I mean, anyone can go at any moment, but I feel like there has been a slight change, or I'm kind of under the radar at this moment. But a lot of the stuff I see on YouTube is stuff I would not say for the sake of the channel, but it's bigger and better. And, you know, I think we're in a Goldilocks period right now, and, you know, there will be another censor hammer now. So my goal is to try and make the channel as successful as possible, because again, I want to be creative, but there's an element of, I want it to be good. The channel has to be successful. I've kind of got that drive. So the plan is, once I'm banned off YouTube, I'm already able to survive elsewhere. So I'm going to have to keep that going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, encourage your viewers to watch you on Rumble. That's what I would say. Try to incentivize them to migrate to Rumble.
Yeah.
All right. And Dardy also said, tremendous stream. Wishing you both a Merry Christmas. Well, thank you very much, Dardy.
Thank you very much.
And finally, Ranulf said, nice to learn about more based Scotsmen. A lot seem to be deranged leftists these days. I wonder if that's changing. What do you guys think of the Scottish Axe Girl? That was in Dundee.
Yeah,
lasting impact? Let's talk about that.
I caught the back end of that, where she was approached by, was that a Romanian guy? I'm going to say Romanian. He was like a a Roma gypsy, which is not, you know, they're like kind of an offshoot of Indians, aren't they? They've never really integrated into European society. So he was a Roma gypsy. And yeah, I think he ended up actually being arrested later on for something. And she, I don't know what happened to the young girl. I mean, in Scotland, having a sharp object is pretty bad. You know, they don't take too kindly to that. The nine knife laws I hear are pretty intense. But lasting impact, honestly, it's too old. It's people have forgotten it already. I think that's a sad reality.
And that was only, what, 4 or 5 months ago? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good memes. The powerful memes make it go longer, but that's it.
Yeah, and that's international. It's not actually what's going on in Scotland with that girl. It's a sort of reality on top of it. The two people who had been accosting her and were filming her did get arrested, as far as I know. They were Roma. I think they might have been from Bulgaria, but wherever, around there, and they were Roma gypsies. And the guy had some sort of, I think, Instagram where he called himself like a gypsy pimp or a Roma. And then right after that, there was a story where a bunch of foreigners of some description were arrested for pimping young white girls in that very area.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it all seems to point, and it turned out that the two girls had gone missing a month earlier. So all of it seems to point to they had either been pimped by foreigners or they knew other girls had been in their area. Yeah, so they were worried, they were scared. And that's why the girl had those weapons with her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because yeah, that's police, like if you ran to go stop her friend. And yeah, it's, we girls just don't carry around massive axes for no good reason. If there's like a Roma pimp. I like the expression, a Roma pimp. Sounds like a Jungian archetype. The Jungian, the Roma pimp.
Yeah, but unfortunately for those girls, it's all too real. And I think it's easy for all of us to forget that's actually someone's lived life, their daily life. They have to worry about the Roma pimps down the road. I mean, and again, this gets us back to this is the wages of diversity. This is what it's resulted in. A town like Dundee, I mean, oddly enough, Dundee University... Yeah, well, and also it just seems like it's going to be utterly Scottish and utterly white, and you know. But the weird thing is Dundee University actually had an Islamic centre like 30 years ago. And I don't think there was even a Muslim population there. It was just that university was for some reason selected to have this Islamic centre. It's been there for a long, long time, probably predating the actual immigration into that area. The point is, this is everywhere now. And that gets us back to what we were saying at the start, that, you know, even two wee white girls, two wee Scottish girls in an insignificant city in Scotland, even they have to worry about this now. And that's shit. And hopefully it will lead to social change in time. All right. Yeah, let's end it there. So this has been a good conversation. Thank you. And I hope people have got a good impression of you, and I hope they check out your channel and subscribe to you also on Rumble. Definitely do that.
Yeah, I've got Rumble. Yeah, check out my latest video. It's a part one of four on the Windrush. It's really good. People in the comments say it's good, so it must be good. Check it out. And I have nothing else to plug. That's about it.
That's it. That's good. That's fine. All right. I'll be back very soon with the next stream. But in the meantime, Old Sterling, good luck with everything. And thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thanks very much for having me. And all the best. I'll tune into the other streams. Not your next stream. I'm going to bed. But all the best.
Okay.
Cheers.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.